Good evening. Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm Assistant Director for Special Collections here in the MSU Libraries. And I'd like to welcome you to the 9th season of the Michigan Writers Series. Before I introduce tonight's guest, I just want to bring your attention to the fact that there's going to be several other writers who will be coming to East Lansing this winter. Robert Fanning will be here on February 23rd. The MSU Student Writers Award Night will be happening on March 30th, often imitated but never duplicated. Jack Rydell and Chris Dombrowski will be here on Friday, April 13th. Jack was here several years ago and put on a great show, and Chris Dombrowski is one of his former students from Hope College, who is now writer-in-residence at Interlochen Arts Academy. So all of this information is up here for you. I hope you take it away, and I hope to see some of you on future Friday nights here in the MSU libraries. Now for tonight's guest. Marsha Aldrich teaches creative writing at Michigan State University. She is the author of Girl Rearing, a collection of linked essays published by W.W. Norton and part of the Barnes & Noble Discoverer New Writers series. She has had essays appear in the Best American Essays, the Beacon Book of Essays by Contemporary American Women, and been nominated for 2 Pushcart Prizes. Last fall, her essay, My Mother's Toenails, appeared in the Best of Brevity, and most recently her essay, The Bed of Metamorphosis, originally published in the Fourth Genre, was selected as a notable essay of 2006. She is completing a second collection of essays tentatively titled The Mother Bed. Marsha will read for about 45 or 50 minutes, and then afterwards I think we'll be available for, where are you?
I'm here.
Okay, all right, there you are. We'll be available for a few questions from the audience. So please join me in welcoming Marsha Aldrich.
Well, I want to thank everyone for coming out on this cold February Friday night. It's quite a tribute. I appreciate it a great deal. I'm very happy to see you all. I also wanted to thank Peter and Michael Rodriguez for the work they do here, and to again follow up, is the sound okay? That we are going to be giving a students from our department will be reading in March. And that's always a very, very fun evening. And I hope people will come back. Some of the students who are here will undoubtedly be reading in a month. So get used to it, this place. And I also wanted to remind people and invite them to our house. Richard, my husband, and I would love to have you come over afterwards. I sent a flyer out to just about everybody. It seemed to me I was sending it all the time. We have moved. We don't live in East Lansing anymore. So you're not making... I have a few extra copies of the flyer with directions. For those of you, I really do hope you come. You have to go down Tacoma Boulevard for a long way, and it is dark. It has no streetlights. It's not like East Lansing. And we put out luminaries in front of our house because it's that dark. I mean, it really is dark. And you can, we hope they're still going to be lit. They're sort of reused from Christmas. You can park on the street. We have some parking in the driveway. I'm happy to have you park there, but you should think about whether you'll be able to get out and whether you're blocking someone, because it's just not that big. So you can park down there. Any questions? I have the flyers there. All right, well, the first, this reading's going to be a little bit different from the usual readings in that I'm going to read a piece, and then I asked two of my friends, Leonora Smith, who's a writer and professor in RAC, and Lynn Fendler, who is a professor in teacher education and just won the Teacher Scholar Award yesterday. I also want to put a plug in there. And they're going to be reading a piece that I wrote for two voices. And so they'll be coming up in the middle. And I am very grateful to them for doing this. And I haven't heard how it sounds. I just gave it to them, and they went off and did it. And they wanted me to stand next to them. I won't say too much. And I thought, what, am I going to make funny faces? I mean, I don't know. I'll be distracted, distracting. Okay. I envy poets. I envy Diane, who can, in the course of a reading, perhaps read, how many poems might you read in the course of an eve? Of a reading. But you get to pick a lot, and you get to pick different moods and different voices and different themes, and prose writers can't do anything like that kind of variety, and the choices are much harder to make, and especially one essay I would have loved to have read tonight is just too long. It's just too long, and I tried to cut it, and I cut it and ruined it, you know, and I just can't do it. So I have to pick something that I can read in the period of time I have. So tonight is going to be sort of a theme of women. And the first essay I'm reading is called Among Women. And it's in the style of a triptych. I'm sure all of you know what a triptych is, but it's a three-paneled painting. So you have two panels on. The first and the third section in my essay sort of mirror one another, and then there's a center section, so it's in three parts. And my daughter's name is Claire. I should have known what I was up against, what the future held right then. I should have known that whatever step I took with her, in whatever mood, with whatever intention, whether reward or punishment, whether acceptance or rejection, or simple love, would prove futile. My daughter would be who she was, and there would be no changing her. There would only be the spectacle of me thwarting her. All was revealed in that moment many years ago, had I been able to understand its meaning. I had arrived to pick Claire up from the house where she was playing with a boy named Sam. She had never visited his house before. His mother, with whom my husband had a slight professional acquaintance, walked me around to the back. There in the sandbox were the children, absorbed in play, constructing their dreams with plastic shovels and buckets and toy dump trucks. The other mother and I paused in the grass a few feet away, exchanging stiff pleasantries until the time should seem right to disentangle Claire and get her round to the front of the house. After 5 minutes or so, the moment came. "Claire, honey, it's time to go," I began. She was pouring water out of a bright blue bucket into a moat surrounding a sandy castle. Her motions implied only that she was having a good time. There was no indication that circumstances permitted human communications of any sort. I was about to repeat my sentence when, working at the moat exactly as before, she uttered the word, "No." It was almost disembodied. There was no shading to it, nothing of the delicate high vaults in the cathedral of social bonds. It could not have been more blunt. Sam, sensing a dangerous fray in the making, pulled himself smaller. He kept pushing his little truck across the sand, but the motion had lost all spontaneity. He lifted his eyes to watch my next move. "Claire, it is time to go," I said more firmly. More firmly still, and now with the feeling of a complete person behind the word, she said, "No." Sam's mother looked on, piqued. The scholar in her was curious to see how I would handle a tough challenge. Sam, I was made to feel, would not do such things. The forced politeness of the situation was a python squeezing the air out of me. I had to keep up the social chatter while I burned with a caustic compound of shame and anger. I tried a brief stage of cajoling, just enough to allow me to consider my options. Cajoling is rarely a successful tactic and always humiliating. Assuming a posture of supplication, the large person shrinks before the child. Stature is not easily regained. Nor can one with aesthetic pleasure look on a parent who begs in a desperate high whine. This much I knew and vowed to avoid the mistake, especially before this older woman who had initiated the playdate and had worked out the arrangements with my husband. With a certain noblesse, she had brought in a child to play, like a pip summoned to Estella in Great Expectations. It was a command performance, really, and my mothering was under unusual audience scrutiny. As a first-timer, I believe the whole globe stopped to watch every time my daughter challenged my authority. While the voice of the maternal world soul whispered, "What will she do?" Indeed, I did not know what I would do or should do now. I stood paralyzed while a round table of experts assembled in my head to debate the best course of action. Part of me wanted to get back in the car and go home without her. Part of me wanted to slap the other mother for standing smugly in her own yard with her own son, who did not have to be removed from his sandbox against his will. Part of me wanted to become enormously large and strong and simply forklift my daughter out of the sandbox from whence she glared at me, into the car we'd go, never to be seen again in these climes. After a survey of tactics, I settled on forklift manique. I attempted to lift Claire from the sandbox so as to set her on her feet in the grass. Since I was not enormously large and strong, however, and lacked all conviction, she writhed out of my grip and bolted with stunning speed out the back gate and into the alley, running with resolute abandon toward the cross street. I hurried after her in maternal terror. Before I could overtake her, she reached the street. If a car had been passing, I would not have prevented her from dashing in front of it. This is a crucial point. Let me repeat. I would have failed to save her. When I did catch up, I grabbed her roughly, swung her over my shoulder, and walked back down the alley where the woman and her son were watching, in their alarm and aversion, displaying a marked family resemblance. I pretended to make light of the escapade. "Oh, my daughter, she's a breakaway," I joked, following up the witticism with a bit of tattered laughter. I walked around the house to the car parked in front, with daughter still flung over my shoulder. Sam and his mother followed, watching from their impressive set of front steps as I harnessed the child's unwilling body into her car seat. I drove two blocks, pulled over to the side of the street, and wept. Thus was the essential dynamic revealed. I could not make her do what she did not want to do. She possessed more raw and undivided stubbornness than I housed power to conform her will to my wishes. Further, the mother-daughter drama would not be private, but would be played out on a vast public stage. If I could paint this drama, a rendering of my imagination, it would be nothing cold or impersonal, abstract or cubist, but a style in which emotions are expressed sculpturally, as in Christina's World by Wyeth. The painting would capture the distance between mother and child, the space at the heart of their bond, a depth no one can fathom and no one bridge. This field of tension would define mother and child more important than either of them individually. On this canvas, Claire and I are fields of force, pushing and pulling against each other across its space. All else is cut away, even Sam and the mother whose home it was. The sequence that led to the pursuit and all that followed are external to the tableau of the defining moment. The viewer's eye is drawn first to the daughter, who strives toward the cross street at the end of the alley, her head flung back to see how she is pursued, and then to the mother, lunging out of the backyard gate into the darkening alley, her face stricken in profile, a gothic convergence of weights and strains upon a slender pyre. The angle of view is raised a little from the pavement, close to this alleyed world and gaining a purchase. The painting merges to a single field with two poles of pursuit and flight, of mother and daughter, forever panting and forever young, respectively, as Keats would put it, and forever with the space between. Part two, or the middle section. Mother is the most powerful word. Mother is the most powerful word in the English language, I think. Mention mother, and the needle leaps in a dance of sensation and memory. The mother's face in youth, a face to launch a fleet of ships, a face you'd want to see emerge from a wall of fog, a face you could hang a life on. But in middle age, my mother's face was stern and disapproving, a look that sent me whimpering to my room. Fear and beauty, beauty and fear, mother. This has been a long and clutching story in my family. My mother had a mother, and her mother a mother before her, and none wanted to be like her mother. In middle age, with a teenage daughter of my own, I feel like my mother, and it frightens me. I recognize in my responses to my daughter, my mother's responses to me, as I became an adult, a transformation she believed I managed badly. I didn't like how she handled me, and now I am perpetuating that handling upon my daughter. The same tones of accusation ring across the generations, with the same result, my daughter finds me wanting. She compares me to other mothers who are more understanding, generous, lenient, open-minded, tolerant, and playful. Before this roster of luminaries, I am deflated and I retreat with hurt feelings. I feel strange need of protection around her, as if everything about me is under attack, the way I look, eat, talk, drive. She has an insatiable need to tear me apart in order to build herself up, just as I needed to protect myself from a mother who would devour me. It is a ritual that must be enacted over and over to belittle the mother, wealth of opportunity. This is how my mother felt. She defended herself against me with identifiable strategies. Disengagement. She withdrew her interest and then her affection, which resulted in a brittle and remote demeanor. Preemptive blows. She'd strike before I had a chance to hide or prepare to put, to put me on the defensive. When those strategies failed, she'd engage in full-scale invasion, as if she were fighting for her life. She erected a hard containing wall of self-righteousness and blamed me for everything that had gone wrong between us. She reconstructed history with supreme creative will. I now recognize all of these techniques in myself. I'm gripped by anxiety because my job is to guide my daughter to adulthood, to keep her on track, to pull her away from the fires of self-destruction. Yet, it is her calling to tear up the tracks and ignite the bonfires. I have sometimes flipped into full-scale invasion, as my mother before me did. I fear my daughter fears I will devour her. My mother still lives within me, after all my attempts to stand apart from her, like a lighthouse in the fog. I am my mother. Sometimes I think it would be better if mothers and daughters lived in a herd, not a house. And were at an early age turned out to pasture with other mothers and daughters. And that over the course of a few seasons, daughters wouldn't know who exactly had born them. And mothers wouldn't know who exactly they had given birth to. And no one would know whose head they were butting up against, whose call they were following, that there was more than enough of everything to go around, and that the only thing they devoured was the long gathering of grass before them. Section three. It is late summer, and Claire is leaving home to live on her own. She is my first child, and she is vacating the premises she and I have called home for 19 years. This is an old story, even a cliche. Right now, the newspapers are full of such stories. There is an article listing 5 easy strategies to cope with the change. The article avoids the word loss, as dentists do pain. Turn this departure, the author advises, into an opportunity for renewal and adventure. Okay, here is my story of adventure and renewal. We have not been getting along. We have not been getting along for the months she has been living at home since her return from Europe, where she traveled for half a year after graduating from high school. We have pretty well torn up the feelings between us and settled into bitter silence. Arguing over what, you might ask? The usual stuff, you know, treating your home like a hotel, and I'm maid service and cook. At the Four Seasons, I tell her, at least you get tips. Never putting gas in the car, or cleaning out the paper cups and candy wrappers, coming in at 4 in the morning, or not at all. Playing Loud Fish and Grateful Dead over and over. Receiving 35 phone calls a day from friends who expect me to take accurate messages. Being generally rude, hostile, and unhelpful. Calling me out when I ask her to clean her room after the wreckage spills into the hall. Making passage to my study treacherous. Announcing she has decided not to attend college and instead plans to move in with 3 boys. Waitressing until she saves enough money to follow Fish on next summer's concert tour. We have both counted the hours in anticipation of her departure. She'd say, well, you won't have to deal with me much longer. I'm moving out in a month, in 2 weeks, in 10 days. You get the idea. And then I'd taunt right back, yes, and it can't come a moment too soon. My anger burned so brightly, it dimmed all the stars in my firmament of love. She packed for days, throwing out bags and bags of what she had accumulated in her 19 years. She'd drive off to the public works department with a load of waste and come back with some piece of furniture she found on a curb. Our garage was a sad collection of ripped and broken chairs and couches, all in a mustard color. Assembling the furniture of her new life, she was feverish with excitement. She even found a Grateful Dead waste paper can at one of the garage sales she prowled. It is Saturday morning, a lovely day with the sun of beaming hope, and Claire is carrying boxes down from her room, loading them into the van, and driving off to her new residence. I feel everything rise that I have pushed aside, pushed down, pushed under. While she and her brother deliver a load, I visit her room. The drawers of her desk, formerly so full they wouldn't close, sit open and clean. Her closet rattles with empty hangers. I can see the floor for the first time in months. The walls are bare except for the picture hooks. The rugs are packed, the bed stripped of its comforter and pillows. The room is emptied of life. And not as a child might take a few things away to college. She has dismantled her place. She has gone through her life and thrown out the past. She knows she'll never be back. This will never be her primary residence again, where she calls home. She is going to make another home for herself on her own terms. I have not allowed myself to see that she is making the end of childhood. If I had confronted her departure in stages, I would have been devastated by increments. Now that my anger is abated, I find an empty room and a departed daughter and a sheet of glass shatters. The story continues thus. This is what I did with my opportunity for renewal and change. I sat down in a chair and wept until my eyes hurt. I poured myself a shot of vodka. And then I started to clean. Not her room. I wasn't ready to clean her room. I started cleaning the kitchen, the parts I clean only in desperation. The oven, the refrigerator, the sticky blinds on the windows, the cabinet shelves, the legs of the kitchen table. Then I poured myself another shot of vodka, this one larger, grasped my Formula 409 cleaning spray, sat down at the kitchen table, and sobbed. I contemplated the filth under the table, but instead made a key decision to tear off the old shelf paper and replace it with clean paper I had bought some time ago on sale. Even in the best of times, measuring is something I don't do. And patterns to me, even sober, are like maps to madness. Anyone who knows me knows this. But here I was, with my half-drained bottle of vodka, eyes mere slits of weeping, trying to put down shelf paper. My son walked into the kitchen on his way to a bowl of ice cream and said, "Oh no." I had gotten the very first sheet folded in on itself and stuck to me. In shape, it did not resemble the drawer it was supposed to fit. Taking pity, he unglued me from the paper. "I don't think you should be doing this right now," he said gently. Nonetheless, I struggled forward and managed to lay paper on a few shelves and in one drawer. The paper has ripples, not the smooth fit advocated in the instructions, and it runs up jaggedly on the sides of the drawer and over the lips of the shelves. I contemplate it now and say, among women. 2 weeks after her departure, I am inside Barnes & Noble, waiting in line to pay for my books. I look out the window. There she is, the tallest of three girls walking away down the street. She was always the tall one emerging at the end of the school day, a giraffe in a toy Savannah. The two other girls have their hair pulled back in buns. She alone wears her hair loose and wild. I pay my bill in a hurry and go out onto the street, but she's gone. At first, I hadn't recognized her. She was just a girl walking with other girls. By the time I saw it was my Claire, she was gone. Thank you. She has read it. And it's coming out. And she said, "Oh, joy." You know, she's so, you know, thrilled to be memorialized that way. Well, now comes the sort of interlude of two other people reading something I wrote. And I just wanted to introduce it in a few little things. When I first started writing it, I wrote it in two columns down the sides. You know, it was two columns side by side on the page. And the left-hand column started with, "I will miss." And the right-hand column started with, "I will not miss." And it was two solid columns. And then in the process of revising, I did away with the introductory part and just plunged in. And I also broke it up into a kind of call and response. So it goes back and forth. And so without much ado, and I guess you would call it a lyric essay, a sort of long poem in two voices. It's not terribly long, but so thank you very much for reading this. And do you still want me up here?
Yes. We have to see if our miking is going to work.
If we speak from here, can everybody hear in the back?
Can you hear
Everybody's
us okay?
Good. Okay. Dirt, inside and out, bulbs, seeds, nuts, cheese, cows, bird feeders, foxes, no creature more intense or more delicate.
Concrete and road signs, men in one room at the solstice party, women in another. My asbestos office and moral hall. Bloated organ men huffing and puffing up death steps.
Champagne, mushrooms, artichokes, fields of strawberries, kneeling and lifting them gently from their stems.
Syllabuses, final grades, annual reports, applying for grants, describing what I do, posturing, bowing down before a man.
Squeezing the blueberry between my fingers until it lets go.
The sum of my errors.
The sum of my errors.
Christmas, funerals, doctor's appointments and reminders, waiting rooms.
Clematis, especially the white ruffled kind and the deep purple. Yellow roses up the chimney, peonies, all types and colors, but most the white tinged with pink and the, oh my God, red.
Lives carved out of butter, hormones, and the call of hunters.
Freshly falling snow, rain over the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, street lights with great glass globes, full moons, leaves in a dry, dangerous wind, reds and yellows banked against the house.
Gravy-stained plates in a sink and cold, thick caution. Keys to unknown doors, answering surveys, shoveling dirty snow, pap smears and mammograms, root canals and crowns. Tarnished silver serving bowls, those vessels of knowledge.
Grass so green as it begins to live, the hydrangea, a carafe of burgundy, meadow drifts of cream-colored daffodil, tincture of jonquils, flannel soft, stargazer lilies like pillowed heads, the blood-red thunder of the poppy, the Japanese maple, tree of doubt.
Vacuuming, my unwelcoming sisters.
White lilacs, armfuls of them.
Days of gray to gray, twisted roadside deer, Christmas trees at the curb with their rags of tinsel.
Drizzle over the water, the thread of smoke, cherry trees in clusters and cherry pies with little windows in the crust. The cello.
Rivers besotted with trash, overorganized religion, pledge drives and board meetings and strategic expansions. Housing developments and strip malls, the smell of gasoline, gas caps.
Dido's lament, remember me, primordial hums, longing, dingle, the great Blasket Island, Doolins of Western Ireland, the Platte River of Western Michigan.
Digs in the guise of jokes, blood red beef, dinner guests bickering or glum, cover letters, submission letters, rejection letters, sleepless nights, obligations, receptions, and repeat.
Blue flowers, elegies, bald eagles rowing over the Huron shoreline, an inner life, cardinals peeking out of the boxwood, the inmost maroon of hollyhocks, and repeat.
Airport check-ins, fill-in-the-dot evaluations, cell phones, fast food, Bahamas birthdays, me home, parents there, birthdays with children gone, life insurance, anniversaries, marriage.
Marriage.
Her naked pleasure in diamonds, garnish around a woman's old neck, chunks on ring fingers, the loud, consumers upscale and down, plastic surgery, elective surgery, SUVs.
Roads to lakes through green canopies of thought, blue herons on the scything river, black swan lagoons, nipples, milk pouring out of my breasts.
Neoconservatives, no, all politicians, publicists, talking heads, boosters, sloganeers, cheerleaders, nattering adsters, foolish remakes.
Planting dahlias, watering, weeding, deadheading, treatises on the unexplicable.
Reporters, agents, talk show hosts, my undesired confessions, secrets from my parents, from my children, from my friends.
Books, their spines, covers, pages, the thingness of them.
And from myself.
Hands, eggs, tiles, wood floors, deep raspy voices, naps, avocados ripening through the night, the laps of large-bellied men, singing mandolins.
Mirrors appalling, people left untold off, weddings of the doomed.
Mittens and velvet, cattails, the dogs of my life. Oh, you majestic heads, the alert of horses, eyes cloud darkened.
Gladiators, bottomless wrath, birds diving at my head, snakes at my feet, defending myself against my rivals and those embittered before I came.
Stories about pigs that burn with a bluish glow told in a wavering, collapsing voice, deer the color of sparrows.
Suicide, the bottom of pools, conversations with me as Atlas holding up the world, making my voice heard in decibels, five-year plans, the relentless pursuit of perfection.
Train tracks and whistles, alleys, bridges, ferries, bear and salmon, headstones off kilter, two births of daughter of son. The light on the front porch, old poems, lungs and vocal cords, pledges made in my sleep, a friend with a beefsteak laugh, Thanksgiving.
Lugging personal history at charity pancake suppers, people telling me how they feel, telling me their complete schedule, telling me...
Peanut butter, clean sheet scents, white cotton nightgowns.
Champions on ice.
Finding what I need in an animal's eyes.
Perky women.
Labor, the struggle of poetry with its explosive breath and head festooned with serpents. Upsurges, crescendos of rain, and then suddenly...
Etiquette in sagging breasts. Body art installations, Diane Sawyer, writers saying...
Abating, easing, softening.
When I was a child, managing my anger. Store managers. Dull
women
sermons and moral
youth.
Equations.
Myth, rides,
cocksure
and
bullies.
From strangers,
bigots.
Who have
the
words
slap
to say,
of the open hand.
Black overcoats.
Whips,
on street corners.
Nightmares entrenched.
Stairs and
Ritalin.
Fog,
humidity.
Toupees.
Father.
Mother.
I knew they'd be good. I could hear both of them. I could definitely hear Leonora on some of them. And you can tell, well, we have an academic audience. I felt a little, all of a sudden I was like, oh yeah, the five-year plan. Surveys, aren't there like eight in my inbox right now that I'm supposed to do by Monday? Don't we have like a ridiculous number of surveys? Yeah, okay. Well, now you know how I feel about them. okay, I think there's time to just read one piece. And this is a piece that came out last year, and it's called Garbo and the Norns. And there are two things you need to know about it. I should just leave it alone, I know. I just should leave it alone. Okay, the Norns are demigoddesses from Norse mythology, and they are in charge of destiny, and they will appear in this essay. And the other thing I'm sad to say, I'm sure half of the audience here absolutely knows who Greta Garbo is, correct? Well, we're older than we think. Because I actually asked, and I won't make people raise their hands, but I think I asked my women in lit class, didn't I, Kellen? And no one knew who Greta Garbo was. I see people shaking their heads, I know. So there are people, is there anyone here who admit that they don't know, who didn't know who Greta Garbo was? Yeah, Liz, thank you. okay, so the other thing is, for those who don't know who Greta Garbo is, we have the older group and the younger group here, and so we'll sort of match them. Greta Garbo was a Swedish actress, hence the Norse, the Norns, for the Norse mythology, to go with the Swedish actress. And she retired from the screen before she hit middle age, or about when she hit middle age. And she was known for her outstanding beauty. Outstanding, that sounds terrible. Like, well, her outstanding weightlifting. For her miraculous beauty and inscrutability, and also a very fine actress. So Garbo is in this essay. All right. I think that's all I need. And I'm probably going to be more uncomfortable than you reading this, so. I shouldn't have said that. Well, my first postmenopausal medical exam was scheduled in late fall, and I did not look forward to it. Even if the examiners speak in low tones and warm their tools, a pap smear and a gynecological assessment are always ignominious. I dreaded the exam room lit by Beckett. The patient, that is me, supine upon the examination table, belly up and legs wide in the pitiless stirrups. We offer ourselves to the heavens, yet we never spread enough, never achieve full disclosure. And the nurse always exhorts to do more. I dreaded the paper gown with impossible ties in the back that never closes and never properly conceals. In my first gynecological exam 30-odd years ago, this gown took on more significance than a closet full of prom dresses. It was my only prop against the masculine and gruff Dr. Zieger, who didn't believe in coddling patients and just ordered me out of my clothes and onto the table. Now, having passed from pre to peri to post-menopausal without a word to a health professional, I knew I would get disapproving questions about my medical care. I hadn't had a period for more than a year. From the time I was 12 until the transition began, I had not missed one, except for my two pregnancies. Even then, it returned 26 days to the hour after the birth. Regular is what I had been, punctual, as if something had been waiting for the moment, holding back, anxious to begin. Even my PMS had fixed stages. First bloating and moodiness, then an intense need to clean the house, a grouse with my husband, sleepless nights, nausea, cramps, all this to usher in the blood. A day or two later came the lifting of mood and spirits, the return of a live and let live grace, the emergence of family members from hiding places. Reliable as the cycle of summer and winter, spring and fall, this was the rhythm of my blood. Painful, inconvenient, messy, debilitating, sometimes cursed. Only now that it was gone could I see it as a blessed sign of youth and life. The word menopause has lost something in the course of its evolution. Not a pause, but a termination, and applies best to the first steps. The disappearance was gradual and erratic. My period became irregular, ceasing for a few months and then, following its own mysterious ways, revisiting. For a long time, I didn't make much of this new pattern, letting it trickle away in the vast reservoir of phenomena I am too inattentive to notice, prefer not to interpret, or don't know what to do about.
For months after its final disappearance, I expected my period to return, like a bear in hibernation, or a favorite TV show on summer hiatus. I waited as if for a tempestuous friend at the train station, ready to meet the pain in crimson glory. But now it was gone forever. Once the process of cessation was finished, I made an appointment to see a doctor, in my usual way of turning the sensible course of things on its head. I am passive about all things medical, and intensely so when it comes to those having to do with sexuality. I grew up during the era of perfect silence on the subject. The sexual revolution never made it to my house. Menstruation, pregnancy, labor, birth, miscarriage, infertility, abortion, menopause, hysterectomy, these happened offstage, behind screens and veils, with whispers across the generations. On these matters, my mother declined to speak. When I think of her, I think of a woman who on the subject of reproduction couldn't help me because she couldn't help herself. She had her hysterectomy when I was in the fourth grade. The conditions that required it must have worsened precipitously, for the procedure was performed after Labor Day, and that Friday, my father drove my sister off to college and was gone for the weekend. Father and daughter loaded the station wagon with sweaters and skirts, typewriter and books, stuffed bears and keepsakes, and other hopeful appurtenances. Our house, to which we had just moved that summer, sat on a plateau at the top of a hill like the Acropolis. And as the car pulled away and down the long, rounding driveway, my sister, never to live home again, my mother, wishing not to be disturbed, lay listless on the chaise lounge in the bedroom at the back of the house, with shades drawn across the long row of windows overlooking the woods. When my father and sister had driven away, I walked to the back of the house and entered the still and dark of the bedroom. My mother was reclining, eyes closed, in the new long chair with its stylish cream and gold fabric, which he had picked for just that spot in its view of the woods. Her draped eyes and marble posture showed that she wanted nothing, and certainly not my questioning presence. I knew only that she had an operation, and I asked her what kind of operation she had. She said, "A female kind of operation." "You mean," I began, unsure where to head next. "A hysterectomy. My uterus was removed." I didn't know what either of those two things was, and when I probed a bit more, she spoke of bleeding. Then her eyes dropped again, and she waved me from the room with a weak hand, unmoving otherwise, head pillowed, nerveless, dozing, as if she and the chair were carved from the same stone, the sculpture of an exhausted god. I spent the afternoon riding my bike down the steep driveway as fast as possible. It curled down between two wooded lots, and at the bottom you could go straight and shoot out into the road or curve right into the blacktop circle with an old oak growing in the middle, where I turned round to ride back up the hill. Each time I raced down the driveway, I took more risk. First I'd lift one foot from the pedal, then a hand from the handlebars. Each trip I upped the ante, until at last I took both hands off the bars, sat upright, closed my eyes, and plunged for the bottom. I opened them just as the world in the form of the oak in the turnaround was coming up fast. I smacked it hard and hit the ground, entangled in my bike. Something was wrong with my right leg. I called for help but knew that no one would come. Our nearest neighbor lived on a farm a half mile down the road, and my mother was dozing in her shuttered room at the far end of the house. I left my bike in a heap and hobbled up the hill, entered the house through the garage, climbed the basement steps, and dragged myself into my mother's room, where she lay insensible to the world. When I roused her, she seemed incapable of grasping what had happened. Over the next 2 days, my legs swelled and throbbed, and then Sunday night, my father came home and took me to the hospital, where x-rays showed the leg was broken. Repairing it was the plum sort of thing doctors were good at, and they clapped a cast on and fixed me right up. And that was my first insight into women's reproductive destiny. As I entered the medical complex for my menopause exam, the sun was sinking toward the horizon, somewhere behind a gray cover of clouds. I found the right office, filled out my forms, and sat till I was called in. After my spell of waiting, a nurse assistant ushered me into the examining room. She was middle-aged, too, but fighting it tooth, bleached white, and nail, lacquered scarlet. Her role seemed to require she crisply refuse any kinship with me. Her hair was a true platinum blonde, almost white under the clinical lights, and she wore a stylish brown suit with a faux fur collar that coiled about her neck. When did nurses stop wearing anonymous scrubs and sensible shoes? I'd avoided the doctor's office so long that whole revolutions in style had occurred. She shoved a paper gown into my hands. That much had not changed, telling me to undress completely and wait for the doctor. I did so, perched on the edge of the white, on the wide examining table, clutching the loose ends of my gown and ruminating on the nurse's fur-wrapped throat and cinematic hair. Like Garbo, I thought. As a young woman, I had watched with intense pleasure the flashing scenes of her classic performances in Camille and Anna Karenina. In both roles, she died tragically young. This was as it had to be, for it was impossible to imagine a plot that displayed Garbo in later age. Far better to kill her off than have her grow old. She must purchase with death her eternal youth on screen. That was the logic. In practical terms, she retired from the movies and withdrew from public view before the age of 40. And yet, I recalled, she regretted her retirement, and there was a single knock on the door, and a younger woman entered, pale and thin, the doctor in her middle 30s, who introduced herself and offered her hand. It was thin and cold, her handshake unconvincing and tense. I wondered what she was nervous about. I was the naked one in a paper outfit. Was she new to this rotation, or did menopausal women put her off? She wouldn't look me in the eye, but glanced wide right, as if searching for a feminine past and future written on the wall behind me. When was your last period, she asked. Maybe a year ago or longer. It had been intermittent for some time before that. Hormone replacement? No. No. Her eyebrows formed quizzical arches. Natural, not waxed, I guessed. Under questioning, I admitted that at the time I last saw a doctor, my blood still flowed like wine. Are you troubled by anything, the doctor said? Hot flashes, vaginal dryness? Well, no, not generally. Had she asked about feelings of general decline and diminishment, I might have said yes. When I was younger and fertile, I listened to older friends talk about menopause, or the change, as they called it, as if they were describing Nepal, a foreign country I'd never visit. Accounts of flashes and fatigue lodged in my brain to resurface now in haunting snippets. Had I listened more carefully and asked questions, I might have noticed that these women had read their portion from the table of fate and been better prepared for what lay ahead. Are you sexually active? Her voice was shaky. She couldn't have been much of a singer, for even her speaking voice couldn't hold pitch. Yes. Yes. From her tone and body language, I intuited that women hitting a certain age were expected to renounce the erotic and swiftly. While I answered the questions on her checklist, she offered not the smallest token of warmth. I seemed to be an abnormal specimen who fit no protocol. When she got to the bottom of her list, she offered a conclusion, or perhaps it was another question that I could affirm or deny. You're postmenopausal, then. It sounded like a death sentence. I was wobbling on the banks of the Styx and would shortly fall in. By now, the assistant in the fur collar had returned for the visual inspection, or exam proper, wheeling an enormous cart that carried, so far as I could see, nothing more than a speculum. She was accompanied by another woman, apparently a supervisor, whose purposes were never announced. I'm not making this up. four of us were now squeezed into the small room, three huddled in a semicircle about the cart, and me splayed on the table, feet in the stirrups. While the speculum warmed in a towel, the nurse assistant asked me the same series of questions I had just answered for the doctor. After the sexually active question, the three eyed each other in a collective smirk. That must be the look of the Norns. The Norse fates, I thought, Earth, Verthanti, and Skuld, who determined the length of life. They lived at the base of the world tree, the navel of the cosmos, but according to the myth, even that grandest of plants withered. The Norns tried to slow the process by pouring mud and water over its branches, and also held the job of carving a woman's destiny into staves of wood. They were imperious writers, no doubt. What could stand against them? Who called them into being and why? Not even the Norse gods could escape their fate, not even Garbo. They were here to determine my allocation of life, and something about my case perplexed them, that I was too young to be postmenopausal, that I was sexually active, that I had passed through the change without expert assistance. When the speculum was warm, the nurse assistant handed it to the doctor, who inserted it timorously. They stood at the foot of the examining table and looked into my vagina and clucked with dissatisfaction. They must have seen a ruin, showing neither form nor beauty. A dead tree rotted from the inside out. This was the final humiliation. I was done for. Of no further use. My body had betrayed me. Time had betrayed me. The weird sisters of medical fate had betrayed me. I was determined to address my doom with fortitude. One can do great things in life lying down, sex, birth, sleep. So I stirred my courage and asked in a timid voice, "What's wrong?" "We can't see," they said. The walls of my vagina would not spread, and all was dark to their mirror. She regretted her retirement. That mattered to me. She contemplated a return to film, but no suitable role came available. The public did not want to see a middle-aged Garbo. That was a contradiction in terms. We could not entertain an older beauty who rode triumphantly beyond youth. Better to let her screen portrait live with us forever, while the star aged off-screen behind heavy curtains. No images emerged to erase or embellish those of her arrested youth. We froze her hallowed head in the world's lit doorways, and ourselves alone groped along its dark streets. She died at the age of 84. The news accompanied on television by a montage of old clips and stills. Impossible, I thought, leaning back from the screen. Garbo old? Garbo dead? In the long decades of her moratorium, global blocks broke apart and reformed. Plagues came. The Himalayas inched upward. The galaxy was reinvented, but no frown ever marred Garbo's perfect brow. Eventually, the speculum did its job, and the three women were able to get a peek through to my cervix. "Ah," they said. They had sighted the roots of life. I used to dismiss Garbo's gorgeous myth. I was still young at the time of her death, roughly her age when she disappeared from the screen. My son was 3 years old, my daughter 7. Teeming with health and possibility, I could have more children if I wanted, as an option, a choice, a door that had not been closed, a door that would never swing shut on its own. When we are robust in health, bending easily, we cannot imagine the fragility of illness, how easily we could break, how hard it might be to rise from our bed. When we are young and fertile, when pregnancy is something we guard against, we cannot imagine the sterility of age. We are eternally gorgeous and rich in our temple. But Garbo happens to us all. Deep inside, the invisible process of age is in full swing, intimate with our fluttering heart. Infertility comes too soon, before our hair has turned a snowy shawl, sooner than is right or just. Suddenly we are alone like toppled columns in a sea of softly rounded mothers-to-be. Yet when we look into the mirror, we greet the girl we used to be. By now the three women in their hissing cart had slithered out of the room. I retracted my feet from the stirrups, reassembled myself, and got my bearings. Signs for the exit, which I followed blindly, pointed down bright empty corridors till I was spun through a turnstile and out into fresh air. The skies were filling with black, and the season's first blooms of snow were lilting down to melt upon the down sepia leaves. Oh, mother, we fall far from the tree of life, tinged red with a final vibrancy. We toss in descent, breaking into a wild freedom that seems for a few seconds eternal. The tree withers, goes bare into the deep snows of winter, prepares for apples or pears in the spring. I wished I had ridden my bike. I would have liked to have held it boldly upright, plant my foot hard on the pedal, swing my leg over and mount. I would have ridden off with reckless abandon, no seer of woman's life, but eyes wide and alive. My heart came up, and I felt a pulsion in my arms and chest. It was good to have the snow on my skin and know, yes, the rhythm of my unrelenting blood. Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions? It went a little longer than 8:30, so, you know, if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, head over to my house. We've got food and wine and beer and, you know, would love to see you. So, you know, I mean, if there are questions, I'll take them. Someone isn't going to say, so when was that when you had menopause? Thank you for coming. And if anyone needs directions to my house, here are some. Please do come.